Now, because I'm too scared to share, so I'll ask three nice people that just enjoy, no, enjoy, I don't know, but they accept the invitation to join us. I will ask Peter, David, and George to join me at the podium. These three people, three gentlemen, one is from New York, one is from the United Kingdom, and I was told this morning that some of his friends are in the room to make sure that we're going to get the truth. Sometimes when you're far away home. So David has to be very careful. And then we have George from Canada. So each one will have about 20 minutes to go each, and a couple of minutes before I'll tell them that that's enough. And you may notice that with my size I was very polite in life. So I won't hit no one. Don't worry, boys. So if you don't mind, help me to join with me to welcome Peter S. from New York.
The cup's going to spill. It's on a slant. Okay.
Oh, good. I took my shower this morning.
Thank you so much. My name is Peter. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
And let me start with a small story. It's all sort of a lot of small stories put together. At 3 o'clock this morning, I got woken up. Now, I had been woken up before in my, I got here yesterday, and I figured out pretty quickly I didn't know how to use the alarm clock, the clock radio. It went off twice in the afternoon when I thought, how do you, I couldn't figure it out. So, but then it didn't go off for a while. I thought, okay, I'm fine. I went to bed at 11, 12 o'clock, and it did go off at about 1:30. And I turned the light on and turned it off. And then at 3 o'clock, all of a sudden, I won't do it because it would be too loud. It wasn't the alarm clock. It took me, the split second. I thought, what's going on here? It was clearly a very loud, very persistent, continuing alarm, and it kept going off. And I'm on the 24th floor of the Hilton, and everything looks wonderful outside the window. I left my shades open, but all of a sudden I realized, oh, my God, the building's going down. I was just convinced. I'm from New York City, and I remember. So anyway, and then finally, after a little while, this is an alarm. They can loudspeak over the whole hotel, and they tell us that there's a problem on the second floor system, but not a fire, and the firemen are there. But this goes on for an hour, the woo woo, and I was scared for an hour. So I thought, okay, what am I scared of? Okay. I thought, I guess HP wanted me to remember that I'm not in charge, and I did get back to bed. And so that fear passed, as most do. Some are persistent, and this was just a little quick reminder. I got a couple of minutes. I'm going to tell a little tiny bit of my story. I'm 48 years old. I'm born and bred in New York City. I have lived my entire life within a 10-block neighborhood. I've never moved south of 81st Street. I've never moved north of 90th Street. If you know New York, that's a very small neighborhood. My entire immediate family lived within 5 blocks. They're all crazy. None of them know how to move away, it's like, let's go, what's wrong with Cleveland? Or Canada, lots of places to go to, but we all stayed within 10 blocks. Way before I was born in the 1930s, my father's family all lived on West 86th Street, There were about 10 different branches of this family that lived within 2 blocks. So I'm lucky that most of them have moved away or passed on, that there's only a smaller crowd. But I was born in a neighborhood that's very nice and was okay and, you know, had its bad years and had its better years. And the point of this is booze, okay? So let's tell a little bit about my drinking. I grew up in a family. I was talking to someone earlier this morning. We were just chatting. It's a New Yorker I know. And we were, you know, I was chuckling how, you know, well, Jews don't drink. The first thing I learned as a boy was how to drink. It was the first thing I remember learning. My grandparents used to visit from California for business and pleasure, and my grandparents both drank. And my grandfather, we had dogs. We had a poodle. They had a poodle. They'd come for business and stay in very fancy hotels, like where I was, with gigantic window views of Central Park or whatever. And we used to go down to visit with them sort of while they were staying in town. And my grandfather would take his scotch. He had a gigantic pinky ring, stone, sapphire, whatever. And I remember the ring because, you know, it sort of, he'd take his finger and dip it into the scotch all the way down, and then he'd go,
like this,
for the dogs. Now, I can't tell you about any other dog, I've never seen it, but Tiger and Gigi loved scotch. These dogs went wild. Guess who came third? I never got his pinky before the dogs. And I have to tell you a secret. I didn't care. I'd like to say that the rest of my drinking was different, but it was pretty much the same as drinking behind the dogs. You know? It was really pretty much the same thing all the way through. Now, I'm not very young. I'm starting to say I'm not very young anymore, but I was 20 years old when I got sober. I'm not arrogant about it. I ran into somebody yesterday who was 17 when he got sober. I know people who were 15, you know, but I got sober young, so what I had to do, for me, I got sober young, what I had to do was pack a lot of drinking into a somewhat limited time. You know, and I drank with my family mostly in my early teens. But by the time I was 16 and 17 in New York City in the 1970s, it was a good time to be drinking. It was a good time to be wandering around the sleazier parts of, there's no sleazy parts of New York City anymore, so everyone can come visit. There's nothing anymore that's sleazy, which also means that a Cosmopolitan costs $13 now. When I drank, nothing cost $13. And I drank, and I drank, and I, sideline, I took other things as well, but I drank. Drinking was my primary and favorite activity. And I drank most of the time, and I can remember it, because I was both afraid of everything and felt like I didn't fit in. I didn't know how to do anything, and I was always afraid that everyone else did, because I could look out of the room of any place in the world. I could go into a room, and I'd know. I wasn't fearful, because it wasn't like a feeling or a thought. It was a conviction. I knew that everyone else knew just what to do. They all knew how to dress right. They all knew how to be cool. Remember, this is the mid-70s, so, you know, it was all about cool, and I wasn't. It was all about belonging, and I didn't. And the fear was, it wasn't even a fear because fear implies that you're, you know, that, well, maybe this will happen. It was a conviction. I knew in the bottom of my heart that I would never, ever, ever belong to anything. I would always be outside of everything. And that was, you know, how I spent my time. So drinking was good. Drinking was perfect. Drinking made me just feel, because I was drunk, I felt like I fit in. And the reality is I didn't even care. You know, it's like, so I'm finished drinking at 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and I'm ready to pass out, and other people are going on to do other things. And I'm not part of it anymore because I'm drunk. But I didn't miss what was going on because I was drunk. So I drank. I drank. I want to say briefly that drinking, my belief is that drinking alcohol hides a lot of other things. Again, I was very young. I wasn't a fully formed adult when I was drinking or when I got sober. I don't think I'm a fully formed adult yet, but and everyone will agree with that if they know me. But, you know, that's another story. But I wasn't in my right mind. I hadn't grown up. I hadn't experienced the things of youth or childhood or adolescence. I hadn't experienced them. I was just afraid of being part of anything. So I stood on the outside by drinking. I did all the things this alcoholic does. A lot of braggadocio, a lot of a veneer, a fakeness, a front. you know, I pretended that I was both richer and poorer than I was, you know, because I wanted to be an extreme on either side, that I was better or worse, but I didn't know how to be one with my peers or part of a group of people, you know, my age. And that's what is unbelievable to me still, and I've been sober for a while. I got sober when I was 20. I'm 48. I go into a room, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, well, you know, gee, they're not. There's no who's 48. Raise your hand. You know, who's me? Who? I wouldn't guess, but okay. You know, who's like me? And you know, part of it, no one's like me, not at all. And then I realize, you know, I've walked amongst, you know, 20,000-30,000 people here in the last 18 hours, and we're all like me, and that's the nicest thing I can imagine. So, a little bit more about fear. Well, I'm afraid I won't have enough to say. And that's okay, too. A little bit more about fear. Fear is still clearly part of, you know, all of the behavior that I drank to hide, all of the feelings I drank. You know, again, I was very young. You would almost say, well, what does he know about these things? Why is he drinking when he's 16? But I just knew that I wasn't right, you know, right in the head, right in the whatever, right in the spirit. I wasn't right. I remember in my religious training, you know, it was all about drinking. It wasn't about the spirit. It was all about drinking. I always knew where they hid the wine in synagogue. It wasn't about going to services. It was not about going to, you know, religious school. It was about the fifth floor closet. That's what it was about. So there too, again, it's every place I went in my, you know, before I got sober, every place I went, whether it was the youth group or whether it was a group in college, you know, a group of like-minded kids or like-minded, no one was like my mind, a group of people who were there for the same purpose, whether it was a chorus or a class in art or whether it was a club to play bridge, or whether it was on a tennis court with other kids, whatever it was, I wasn't like it. I wasn't like them, and I didn't fit. I did not fit. I just said, gee, they're different. And, you know, I could, as I said, I could look in this room, and if I want to, I could say, oh, there's 18 zillion different things that make people different than me. But I don't do that today, usually, or I stop at my brain. But when I was drinking, I was able to differentiate between me and everybody else in a million ways. And so I was full of fear, you know, that I would never fit in. So I got to AA in 1977. I didn't get the lesson for about 5 months, because I didn't hear, and I'll speak for me, I stopped drinking when I got to AA, but I didn't hear anyone say, you're not supposed to take those drugs. I didn't hear it. Cotton was already in my ears. I didn't hear it. So March of 78 was my clean and sober date. And I remember that instantly there was a change. It was slow. It's still slow, 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 because I felt different then too. And the fear in my head that backs up on me all the time or springs up on me all the time, that you're just not going to fit and you're not going to belong. I mean, I can tell myself, I'll leave this room later, and if I see anyone here, they'll turn and they'll walk away because they won't want to say, hey, Pete. You know, but I have never in AA met somebody who hasn't said, hey, Pete. It helps when I have my name on, you know, because otherwise it'd be, hey. So I don't need to be afraid. You know, the alcoholic trait, the personality, the character defect that is fear is still there. No one has ever promised me that it would be a perfect life. They just said it would be a sober life. So the things that go through my head, which are you won't belong, you won't have a reason to be here, you won't be like anybody else. No one, you know, God forbid, nobody wants to hear you or see you or like you, you know, or no one is like you. That's still what my disease would say. And my disease still talks. It doesn't usually say booze is the answer, but it says isolation is the answer. Run away, stay in your hotel room, stay in the airport and wait for the next flight home. You know, it says a lot of things. It says, be gone. And I try to reverse that and say, be gone to, you know, to my disease. And it's really hard. You know, I just say that because I don't think there comes a day, hasn't yet, when I wake up and say, everything's just perfect, I have no problem, because I'm still an alcoholic. But at the same time, I don't want to wake up and say, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have alcoholism, because alcoholism reminds me, you know, and I have a lot of friends in New York, a lot of friends in a lot of places, and most of the people I'm still close with, 15, 20, 25 years later, we still go to meetings, because we still all know that everything can be perfect, and I can have a house at the beach, and I can have a trip to Toronto, and I can go to the south, of, I can go any place I like. I was just talking to some people. I was in Ireland 2 months ago. I went to a meeting. I didn't have an idea what they were saying. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't follow, but that's just me, you know. I speak American, but not English. I speak New York, but not even American and not English. But even there, I wasn't afraid because no one looked at me and said, boy, you can't be in here. We don't know what you're saying. Or, you know, you can't be in this room. And so I think it's the luckiest thing in the world that I can go to 70 countries, 90 countries, however many, you know, 107 countries. I don't keep up with the numbers. However, you know, there's 100 and something different countries in the world where AA has got a foothold or a toehold. Whoa, I was slow. 150 nations in the world where AA has a foothold. Yeah. And you know, what need I fear? Not a lot, you know, not a lot. I read The Grapevine every month. I think it's the best thing in the world. And I was reading yesterday about people on planes or in airports pulling together a little impromptu meeting. I was on a cruise ship in Greece about 10 years ago, and I asked whatever they call them, Julie the purser, Julie the your host. I said, is there, and there was a thing, your friends of Bill W. And I went to this room where and strangely enough, there was no one else there. So for about 30 minutes, I was the meeting, you know, and I talked to myself. If any of you have listened, you'll know that I do that a lot. You know, and I wasn't afraid. You know, and part of me was afraid. You know, I can pay the bill, but I still don't feel like I belong someplace. So I was on a cruise ship in the Greek Isles with friends, but still said, I'm all alone. And I can be in a room of, you know, 200 people. I tried to do this, 8 on each side times 12. You know, I couldn't, close to 250, you know, and I'll feel alone. And I'll walk outside later, as all of us will, I think. Or many of us will. And we can be sitting next to somebody right now who's new or not new to us, and we'll go home and say, well, you know, there's no one here for me. And yet there is. And I've never been alone. New York is, again, you know, I just have to say, New York, if you've got to get sober, go to New York. If you're, you know, new, go to New York. There's a meeting. You don't need a car. You can walk to every meeting in town. It's amazing. It's the best place. That's why GSO is there. Okay. Yeah, that was really an underhanded pitch. Okay. If you're in New York, go to the GSO offices. You know, the exhibits that are out here, it's just, not only are the exhibits unbelievable, but they've got the best view of the Hudson River and New Jersey you've ever imagined. It's a wonderful building. And, you know, we're not alone, and we need not fear anything, because there's always someone with us. And even when I'm alone by myself in bed and the alarms start ringing at 3 o'clock in the morning, the curtains were open, I looked out, the Tom Cruise and the Martians were not there from the War of the Worlds, and I thought, I'm not alone, and I need not fear. I might get afraid again later today when I walk outside, but that comes, and then I'm lucky that goes away. And that goes only because of the fellowship of AA and the program in the Big Book. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Now I've got the answer. I know why we are 93 delegates. I am one of them, by the way. Did you get anyone there? Don't worry. And we are 93. Out of them, 4 comes from New York. And we have to get the control there. Would you imagine a run by Peter? We have a good service structure. I believe in it. Yes, 150 countries now carry the message. And this is mainly because of you, of your help, of your aid. I hope I got the right word to carry that message. We have over 2 million people around the world that have a sober life, happy, and try to be happy. I love the Peter's way of bringing or carrying the message. And even if I'm a French guy and I don't understand your language, I don't understand U.S. language, but I understand the language of the heart. And yesterday I met German, I met Italian people, and only with the eyes I was able to say, I'm pleased to be here, I'm pleased that you are there. And Peter this morning said to us that you'll never be alone. And I was so scared when I tried to get sober, because in French we have another word called abstinence, which means that you don't drink. Sober is something that you do with some, oh boy, we'll do it afterwards. I'll try to find my words. Sober is something that you can eat, but without excess. So I don't drink for a while, and I completely lost my idea now, trying to find my words. So I will be back to you. I have that chance to be back. And our husband now, from the United Kingdom, David, to share for us.
Thank you, John, and good morning. My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. And in common with most alcoholics, I come from one of the best little home groups ever in Kidbrook in South East London.
Another one.
Thank you, John, for opening the meeting, and Peter for sharing. And I was sitting there and I was thinking, well, thank God the theme of this thing is fear as a stepping stone, because I now, once again, have been reacquainted with fear. Not that it's ever been very far away from me in my life, but, you know, there are those moments when, you know, the bum cheeks just clinch together and... And I asked myself this deep, meaningful question about, what the hell am I doing here? Well, I'm here because I'm privileged to be sober. That's primarily it. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was broken and wretched and wrecked, and having created disaster after catastrophe in my life, I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dublin, in Ireland. So even though I live in the UK, I'm very proud of being Irish and being from Dublin. And if the good people of London took me to their hearts when I arrived after a couple of years sobriety, a lot of the edges had been knocked off me by the good people of Dublin, because when I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dublin, I wasn't really there because I wanted to stop drinking. I was there because I was in terrible trouble. I knew I was mad. I knew I was bad. And I couldn't see no light at the end of any tunnel. And the only access for me was, as far as I was concerned, was the final solution. And like every good drunk, when I took myself away to kill myself, I had a drink first. And when you have a drink first, what happens? You have to have another one. Thank God for alcoholism. Because I wake up 3 hours later and think, didn't do it. But maybe I'll have another drink. And isn't it wonderful that we can laugh at this awful, awful time. Because let's not lose sight of what it was really like. You know, the truth of it was that feeling of despair, that dark, dark place that I was in, had led me to the place that told me that life would have been, the world would be a better place without me. And when I walked into the rooms, or crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me different. And even though I didn't believe, I just hung in there for a while, and we have the little saying that says, well, hang around long enough for the miracle to happen. And I began to understand that, well, maybe, just maybe, this Egypt could make something of his life, which had been up to now been not much use, really. Fear had always been part of my life, and in many respects, one of the pieces that still to this day kind of mesmerizes me is why. Why was I afraid? I have a nice mum and dad, you know, who looked after me, who cared for me. There was lots of love in our house. And yet, just like Pete described, I was different. Didn't fit in. Always seemed to be better next door. I always felt that maybe, if I was born into the wrong family, I should have been in my best mate's family because his mum and dad were different. I had a view of what family life was, and it came from, you know, the television set, really. I believed that family life should be like the Waltons or Little House on the Prairie or something such like that. My family wasn't like that. It was equally as good, but different. But I couldn't distinguish between the difference and being good or bad. As far as I was concerned, if it was different, it was wrong. And the truth of it is that described me right through my life, is that it didn't matter who you were or what you were better than I was. I had no reason I don't know why I hung on to that, or whether that was just the hole in my soul in many respects. But that feeling of inadequacy was to drive me right through my life. Less than, not much good really. And yet, just like Pete described, I had that other corner of me which saw me as better than. And when if you're like me and you live in a constant state of inadequacy, sort of the consequence of that inadequacy for me was fear. Because I was always afraid. I was afraid of you wouldn't like me. I was afraid that you would like me. I was afraid of going to school. I was afraid of staying at home. I was afraid of everything. And, you know, not that I would have been able to put words on it in those days. You know, I mean, I described myself, those who know me from London, and I'm great to see some of you guys here today just to give me a bit of support. I often described myself as a child. I was a nervous child. What they would describe at home in Ireland as a nervous child. I was very nervous, and I was frightened. I spent my childhood being frightened, and I was frightened. And whatever little illness that was going, I got it. I have a lovely mum, but she's slightly neurotic. So she had me well wrapped in cotton wool and protected and looked after. And whatever illness happened to be around, I picked it up. You know, so that made me different again. You know, I was kept indoors even when the sun shone, because I had a weak chest. Nervous again. You know, and, you know, when I look back on a lot of my childhood was filled with a loneliness. Because I didn't fit in. And when I did get out to play with the rest of the guys, I was an oddball. Because the sun would be shining and they'd be in t-shirt and shorts and I'd be in a muffler. Weak chest. Now, none of this explains why I'm an alcoholic. This is just, if you like, sort of picture background, if you like. I was 16 when I met alcohol. And funny enough, one of the great gifts of coming to Toronto today was... this week was that I recontacted a cousin of mine that I haven't seen for 30 years who lives not far away, and we've had dinner together, we've been out in his home and we've reacquainted ourselves. Sean bought me my first drink when I was 15 or whatever, and that was okay. That didn't create any damage in many respects. But very shortly thereafter, I was in a situation where I picked up alcohol seriously for the first time. And the explosion happened in my head. And all that nervousness and all of that fear and all of that disconnection and all of that thing that made me different disappeared in an instant. You know, and I became all powerful. I became everything that I ever wanted to be in that instant. I discovered that I could sing. Not a pretty sight. I could dance, and my children say I dance like a frenetic chicken. I care less. I've got perfect pitch and movement up here in my head, but it just doesn't translate to my feet. I could tell you funny stories. And I was okay. For the first time in my life, I felt that I was okay. And I spent 20 years chasing that buzz, you know, with all of the consequences that comes from drinking like we drank. It created mayhem. It destroyed lives, not just mine. And I have a very good friend of mine at home, my friend Bill, and he's not one of us. He's kind of normal. I mean, and we drank a wee bit together, but he could go on the tear and then wouldn't drink for a week, which is kind of strange. But he's the only friend that I've left really from childhood. The rest I used and abused to the extent that they're no longer in my life or I'm no longer in theirs. And I remember Bill's wife asking me one night, she said, was it worth it? And I said, what do you mean, was it worth it? She said, well, I remember you the way that you were all of those years. And I see you now and I see the difference. And it's obvious that the price that you had to pay for what you have now was the hurt and the pain and the being afraid from the way that you drank. And my instant reaction, my immediate kind of knee-jerk reaction was, yeah, it's worth it. You know, to have gone through all of that 20 years of strife and trouble and all the rest that goes with it, to have what I have now. And I suppose the only thing that resways that balance slightly for me is the fact of other people. You know, I had a mum and a dad were destroyed by the way that I drank. You know, I was my mum's eldest boy and she had pretensions of grandeur for me. I mean, I was very good at picking up on those myself. But she had expectations, you know. She had me down as being Pope. And if it was to be the other land, maybe President. Do you know what I mean? But it's those expectations, while we can laugh at them or I can laugh at them, they were very real to that woman. You know, and they were crumpled. And they were tossed aside, just like she was. In fact, just like everybody was who was in my life. You know, alcohol is a great abuser, you know, and I abused the alcohol and it abused me and I in turn abused everybody that I came in contact with. Many years ago I heard a guy say in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, if you knew me, you were affected. And I kind of thought, wow, that's kind of a wide statement, isn't it? But it was true. If you knew me, you were affected. If I worked with you, you were affected. If you were my friend for a short period of time, you were affected. You know, because I would either borrow money from you on a permanent basis, you know, which is the long-term repayment, not this week, maybe next week, kind of stuff, or I would use and abuse, because the self-centeredness and the requirement and the need that I had to fill this hole inside of me, which was full of fear, was basically the thing that drove me through my life. The other side of fear is what do I do when I feel the fear? Just like Pete described, you know, why am I not on the next plane out of here? And the feeling of inadequacy that comes with who I am. You know, when we stood at the door and we were welcoming people coming through the door and it was great to be part of it, you know, the fear, the inadequacy in my head said, what are you going to say? Now, I've never been stuck to say anything, because those of you who know me say, you know, once I start talking, it's very difficult for me to stop. And I got taught in very early days in my early recovery. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through a recovery unit. And a lady there told me that I had very little opportunity, very little chance of getting sober, because I was mad. Do you know what I mean? And on all of the stuff I could understand really intellectually, I had a real good handle on it. And I learned the language of Alcoholics Anonymous really quick, so that I could appear recovered. You know, another friend of mine refers to the word fear as frantic effort to appear recovered. And I could do that. I could do that real rapid quick, you know. So I got to know how to play the game real quick. But in terms of it meaning anything, in terms of it meaning anything other than at a very superficial skin level, it took me a long time. And this dear lady who took me under her wing in when I was in this treatment unit, and she said to me, "You've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "You have got to go on a very often, as often as you can make it, a minimum," she said, "of 3 meetings a week," because she knew I couldn't do any more, because I would have gone away if it was too prescriptive for me. And then she made me promise that I would open my gob at every meeting. And that poor woman is dead now, because, you know, time has moved on and she's passed away. But I'm sure she's turning in her grave now because of the wee words that she gave me in terms of opening my gob at every meeting I go to. Because I found that, you know, and when Jan talked earlier on about, you know, my friends are here to ensure that I speak my truth in many respects, I'm stuck with that in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless I speak my truth, when I speak the words out loud in within the four walls of a room of Alcoholics Anonymous or in the confidence of my sponsor, I'm stuck with honesty. And I don't know where that comes from, because my natural feeling, because of the fear, is to be dishonest. My natural place is to tell you lies so that I can imagine what you would think of me. And it's how I survived. You know, as a drunk, it's how I survived. When I sat on a bar stool, if you came from Canada, I would just immediately sort of come in and I would click onto a Canadian accent and I would converse with you in your language, because I would immediately hone into what you wanted from me and I would provide it. Because if I provided what you wanted, then you would like me, or then you would buy me a drink or whatever. And my natural inclination is to embellish or to exaggerate so that you know, I would be better then. And it comes from the fact that I feel inadequate in many ways. And the truth of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I am stuck with this truth. I'm stuck with who I am and what I am. And when I share that with you honestly, you identify. When I started around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard some people say some wonderful things. And I used to rob them. I'd plagiarize what you said, right? And I'd whip it down to the next meeting. I'd be very, because I'm a cute alcoholic, I'd have a little look around just to make sure that there was nobody in the room who'd been in the room the day before. And I'd share it as my own. Because I wanted so much to be accepted in a place that I, you know, because I'd never fitted in. And I could never understand why nobody identified with me when I shared your story. Everybody identified the day before. So I'm kind of stuck with that kind of honesty. And through a set of circumstances, I was forced through the pain of trying to get well, and I had sort of acted out in some stuff. I can tell you what I did. I was a house husband, you know, which means I was unemployable when I got sober. And my wife, who's here this evening and this morning, was gone into full-time work to try and support us. And I was trying to get the kids ready for school. And I had maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months sober, whatever. And my wee boy, who was near 20, 26, 27, he was 8 at the time, got very, well, he pressed whatever buttons he pressed, and I was emotionally unwell, and I reached out and I hit him. And I hit him so hard that I left the imprint of my hand on his face. And I was distraught. You know, if this is what sobriety is about, I can't do this. And I can still see it today. I still feel it. And when I share it, I feel it every time. And he went to school, and I had to go into town to pay some money off a light bill. And I was trying to drink a cup of coffee in a restaurant in Dublin called Bewley's of Westmoreland Street, which is very famous for those alkies, because we used to gather around various tables, and I didn't know which way was up, really. And the man sat down and he said, "Are you okay?" And he knew me from the meetings. Well, he kind of knew me from the meetings, because I'd been arriving at meetings, you know, just bang on time and disappearing at the door just 1 minute thereafter. "Gotta go, fellas. I'm okay, fine. Thank you." And for the first time in my life, was honest. And I told him I was afraid. And I told him I was ashamed. And I didn't know which way it was up. You know, he identified with me. It was the first time I had ever felt in all of my living life at 36 or 37 years of age that I wasn't alone. And we spoke for a couple of hours and we went to a meeting and I shared it. And you know what happened? People identified with me. And that was the start of me getting well in many respects. The rest of the stuff beforehand was really important. It was important about me being abstinent from alcohol. It was important about me trying. The solution sometimes takes a wee bit of effort, it takes a wee bit of time, and it doesn't always click in my time. My timetable and my higher powers timetable vary quite a bit, and we have some discussion on it on a regular and ongoing basis. He is always and ever delivered, but I really have to sort out his scheduling. And the reality for me is that whatever fear, if as I live in fear, I also live in courage. Because sometimes the stuff that makes me fearful is minuscule and meaningless to anybody else. But to me, it is fearful. So sometimes for me to pick up a telephone, to talk to somebody, to talk to my sponsor, talk to my bank manager, talk to somebody at work, takes all of the courage that I have. But I have it in abundance, you know. I have it in abundance because on a daily basis I have a step 3 which enables me to tap into the great source. Don't always do it because there's that alky part of me that sort of, you know, gets on with my life and sometimes I argue the toss. But when I tap into the great source that's there, I have as much courage as I need to deal with any fearful situation. So I'm forever grateful. I thank you for your company, and I wish you a great weekend. Thanks very much.
When I go to the mic, do you run away? I don't take it personally. I love. Thank you, Dave. I don't know if you noticed. I didn't notice that he has an accent. And I this morning I find another reason, answer to that question. When do I stop drinking? That I never stopped drinking, by the way. I just woke up the morning and my thirst was away, so I have no effort to make, thank God. But and I heard that when I started, and this morning, that's what Dave told me. I will go up to the limit of my capacity, regardless where you drink, how much you drink, with whom, and whatever. You have to go to the limit of your capacity. And that's what they told me this morning. Again, I thank you very much, Dave, for that. The last but not the least, today is Canada Day, by the way. No, we won't sing the national anthem. I'm sure that you don't know it. It's a challenge. If we have time at the end, we'll see what we can do. Welcome. Let's welcome George from Canada.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Acceptance Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and my name happens to be George. Hi, how are you? Happy birthday, happy AA birthday, happy birthday to Canada. I'm really glad to be here and sober, fully dressed, and in my right mind. Someone canceled out, and I'm pitch hitting for someone, and I'm just glad to be anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it's making coffee, shaking hands, or just receiving your love. So I'm really glad to be here and sober. And by the looks of your smiling faces out there, you are too. So anyway, What it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. What do I got, 45, 55, 65 minutes? Yeah, there you go, right on. Yeah. When I first came to AA, I heard about fear. Our theme here is fear, a stepping stone to growth. Hopefully I've grown a little bit. I got to tell you a little bit about my sobriety date. It's August 1st, 1995, and if I stay sober for a few more 24 hours, I'll come up to 10 years. But what's really important, thank you. That hand of applause goes to AA members, goes to you, and I'm sure if there's perhaps people in Al-Anon and friends of AA, it goes to everybody, because we work together and hang together, else we finally die alone. But when I first came to AA, I started hearing some really funny language. I heard some really funny language in the bars and the booze cans and on the streets. But when I first came to AA, I heard that there was beggars here. And I thought, well, people stemming for their next drink, I've done that. And they said, no, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Right? From the very start. Although I haven't followed your direction well, I'm on that course a little bit today. So hopefully I can illustrate a little bit of growth there. The other thing, too, is as we look through the program, the theme is I am responsible when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help. And for that, I want the hand of AA to be there. So somewhere prior to August 1st, 1995, I was sick, sad, and sorry, and I reached AA, and your responsible hands and hearts were there to help me. And I'm really, really grateful, and hopefully I can illustrate that in a 15-minute talk and take my seat. I'm nervous. And, well, things happen for me when I become fearful. And there's steps, they say there's a kit of spiritual tools which light our feet. And you show me how you use your tools, and you don't tell me that I have to use mine, but you say if you want that easier, softer way, you might want to, before you begin, ask God for help. So before I began this morning, I asked my higher power for help. And it says, we think about the 24 hours which lie ahead. Before we begin, on our course for today, we ask for help. So I ask for help. But just because I ask for help, that doesn't mean I still don't have moments of fear. They'll say there'll be moments of indecision. So there's moments of fear. And what happens with me when I get fearful, I like to paint a nice picture. I'm not scared. Like today, I'm not fearful. I'm just extremely alert. A few other things happen to me. When I get nervous and fearful, I get gas. So you'll be doing more and singing the national anthem when we're done here. A little bit of the drinking. I learned at a really young age. I'm not sure when I became an alcoholic, if it was predisposed, whatever. I learned at a really young age how to drink. And I liked it. And I didn't learn about alcoholism and more about alcoholism until I started coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thought alcoholism was associated with my drinking and who I drank with and the high places and the low companions and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't start to learn about alcoholism until I started to hang with you folks. Again, we hang together and work together. Most of us finally die alone. So there's a lot of people dying that haven't learned about alcoholism yet. So it's coming upon me to listen to you so I can go out there and share it with them. And I really, really am grateful that the message is still the same. 70 years, just think, 70 years ago, sometime this time, a couple drunks got together. And here I am today. Our story is just closing in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. So I don't need to tell you any dates, times, stories. But I got to tell you that my first AA meeting was sometime around April of 1977. I had just turned freshly 16 years old, and I got picked up by the local police, joyriding in someone's car that we had borrowed, intoxicated with someone's booze that we had stolen, and trying to do that learned behavior thing, keep it down, keep it down. And what it did for me back then, alcohol, was, it changed me. It changed some of my feelings. And I watched some of those older people. When they drank, they appeared to have fun. So that's kind of where my journey was when I could associate alcohol with fun. And then I started drinking with other types of characters, and it was fun with a few problems. And then near the end, near those fateful days, and I think that they're really great days now, but going through it, they were fateful. Near the end of that, it wasn't fun anymore. It was a necessity. I didn't realize, because I hadn't learned about alcoholism, because I hadn't really been exposed too much to AA, that I was drinking this one and already thinking about this one, right? So I'm learning all this stuff as I get here. Still no gas yet, but really, really nervous here, so I got to lighten it up a little bit. And it's kind of fun. There's lots of jobs in AA, so I thought the most important job in AA was standing behind a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it isn't. It's a pleasure, it's a privilege, and that's all that kind of stuff, you know. And they would tell me that if in fact you ever have the privilege and the opportunity, don't say no anytime, anywhere, anyone reaches out for help. But if in fact you are, you know, there's a couple basic things that you must do from behind the podium, you know. Suit up, show up, and try to stick to the truth. And they say try to stick to 20 minutes because the ass can only absorb what the mind can stand, right? Or the mind can only absorb what the ass can stand. So I know my bum was getting, although my bum wasn't getting tight like the other speakers, my bum was getting sore there. So in fairness to you, I'm going to wrap this up as quick as possible. So listen closely. I'm really happy to be here. What happened, it was I met my wife, AA campus. You know, boy meets girl in AA, you know. And prior to coming, I had been exposed to some AA a little bit, but I was around AA, not in it. In fact, I wasn't sober yet. And I'm in this town in Toronto, and I meet this girl. And she had the resources, and I had the enthusiasm. And what happens is she'd order these cases of alcohol. And, you know, I want to be polite and pleasurable. So they'd bring them in, and I'd be stocking the fridge, right? But I already knew the learned behavior of the alcoholic, drinking this one, thinking about this one. Well, there's only a few cases, so I'd better hide some for later because, you know, at the 2 o'clock in the morning hour. So what happened was I was filling a fridge, and I opened a tea towel drawer to hide a couple of beers, and there was already some hidden.
Yeah.
We're both happily sober and married in AA, and that's fantastic. I got to bring you up to my last drink. I would come to AA and I'd hear the old timers. I just loved the old timers, the long timers. I just loved the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would hear them talk about that first drink and how their drinking progressed and where they were at the end and how they surrendered to the fact that their case was hopeless and where they are today. So I'd be really young. I'd be, you know, in my teens or in my 20s and in my 30s, and I'd be at these meetings. I'd be listening to these people that are standing behind podiums talking about their dry dates. They'd say, all you need for AA is to know your first name and your last drunk, right? And I'm thinking, I'm there, shaking my head, yeah. Although I'm scared, I'm at a meeting trying to get sober, trying to come to terms with the fact, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, but I'm at an open meeting. And what would happen at those meetings, there'd be someone up here and say, my name's Charlie, and through the grace of God and the 12 steps found contained in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since April 1st of 1939, and for that I'm grateful. Right? And then someone from the back of the room would say, baloney, Charlie, we seen you drunk last week. Charlie say, well, that might be true, but it wasn't necessary. You know? So it's not necessary that we pick up a drink. And we've got to remember, too, that drinking is only a mere symptom of our underlying problems. Part of those underlying problems are the stuff that you told me about in the beginning, in my early days of AA. You begged me to be fearless and thorough. And you started me on a journey with those 12 steps. And you told me I wasn't alone. You pointed to step one as a WE program. It's a fellowship, you know. Come and join what we have. Join us. Take freely what you have and join us. And stuff like that's just been fantastic. I'm still really nervous. So I was going to tell you about that woman AA meets on campus. So what I do is, you know, there's the alcoholic, right? I heard someone allude to the normal person. I got a sponsor that says normal is just the setting on the dryer. But anyway, I'm not sure if I'm normal or what. But the thing is, so I want to be here for a long, long time, a day at a time. I want to be an old timer. You know, when this thing is, you know, 150 years old, you know, I want my kids to be here and I want your ancestors to be here too, right? So it's incumbent upon me to do a few basic things on a daily basis. And it's, you know, the five basic things that they told me when I first got here have not changed. Don't drink, go to meetings, join a group, get a sponsor, and in really small brackets, they said, pray if you can. I started coming to these meetings in Toronto, and I met with these old-timers. One of them was this guy named Spud, right? And he said that he would sit on the same bus every day coming to meetings, and he'd see the same person snapping their fingers, right? And he would teach me about the importance of going to AA meetings, right? And he'd tell the story about the guy on the bus snapping the fingers. So you get on the same bus. So finally, after years and years and years, a day at a time, he'd ask this guy, he says, why is it every day that I see you, you're sitting in the same spot snapping your fingers? And the guy responded, and he says, it keeps the taggers away. Spud says, there isn't a tagger within 500 miles. It's like, very effective, isn't it? Yeah. So AA meetings are very effective. Right. It keeps my taggers away. Let's talk about fear. You know, it says that our whole existence is just all the way through with it, right? But back to the story about, because, you know, I'm going to buy the CD and take it home and tell my wife, look at honey, I was talking about you, you know? And I speak very highly of you. And what it is I want to be like you. I want what you have. And I can't transmit something I haven't got. So I hang around with you. And you show me what it's all about. But anyway, so if you can picture this, I come to AA, sick, sad, and sorry, a broken man, and I find what you have, and I take it out there, and I transmit it, and I become happy, joyous, and free as I trudge the road of happy destiny, not to of, because it's a journey. And near the end of my life, there I am with Janice. And now we're able to travel the world, and we're in a third world country somewhere, on vacation, just going to make it to an AA meeting to meet new friends in the fellowship with Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're out in the town square in a small village, and we're walking counterclockwise, but the law of the land was, it's against the law to walk counterclockwise. You must walk clockwise in the town square. So on the books, the law was that they'll put you to death at a public execution. So they arrest us, and they bring us out, and they cart me out first, and they said, do you have any last requests before we put you to death publicly. And of course, me being an AA guy, I said, yeah, I just want to tell my story one more time. What it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And then they asked Janice, and how about you? She said, yeah, please shoot me first. Really? Okay, now the fear part. People kind of candy-coated things for me. You know, I couldn't get my head around the in-depth version of Step 7. I wanted the promises, but they said that they would start to come through my life once I reached Step 9. So I had to go through a process, right? And one of the promises talked about fear. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. The people won't, and the insecurity won't, but the fear will. So there's been moments, just like moments of clarity, there's been moments of fearlessness that have left me because I've been scared of people and I've been scared of some failure. Don't know how to handle money, and God's been so good to me. You know, whether it's money, property, or prestige, and I still struggle with that daily, right? So there's still room for growth. But to the point of the theme of the meeting is, we use that fear to prod me along. It's like a wake-up call. Stay alert, Georgia. If you're scared here, there's a real reason. Your higher power's helping you. And usually I find that help through a sponsor. And it's not until I have 20/20 vision when I look back and see how fearful I was, and I move forward through that fear, I can see, oh, okay, that was the motivator. That was the stepping stone. And how you candy coat it for me was, I didn't understand any of these words in the language of the heart and all that kind of stuff. I just knew I had to hang close with you and watched you. And that's where the faith came in. I had a little bit of faith in step two, some honesty in step one, and then I started turning over in step three. And they would just say, you know, get to a meeting, get to your sponsor, join a group, get active, pray if you can, keep snapping those fingers, it's very effective. And here I am today. And I need to tell you how you candy coated it for me was, you broke it down. And here we replace negative with positive. I come here and I tell you a whole bunch of stuff that's wrong, and you kind of nod your head lovingly, and you can say, well, yeah, that's the problem, but there is a solution. And you'll move me from that problem into a solution, not by telling me what I need to do, but by sharing with me what you do. And I can't fault that. And I just get all tingly just thinking about the hundreds and hundreds of people that have shared with me from the very depths of their soul how they get through it. More towards that candy-coated thing was, the negative was, forget everything and it was frig everything and run, right? I cleaned it up because we are at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then someone would turn it around for me and says, face emotions and recover. You know, so it's all about my emotions and how I need to come to terms with that and share it with you. And as you take me through that process of the steps, what's incumbent upon me is there's going to be a new guy behind me. So I can't get rusty. I can remember my drinking days. I just wanted to get the edge off. I didn't want to rust it. I didn't want to freeze. I just wanted to be somewhere. And because I'm an alcoholic and I'm powerless, I'd always lose control and go over the top. And here we are in sobriety, and I do those same things. I just want to be leveled off, but I'm always up and down like that roller coaster. And now it doesn't have to be a roller coaster. I'm told by you that it can be a miracle realm, and it's really fantastic. I think that we don't have a lot of time left. The three legacies. The legacy is recovery, unity, and service. I believe in my life only, and I only speak for myself as an alcoholic, I believe that it's incumbent upon us that it's attraction, not promotion. I have to show you sometimes that I'm not as fearful as I once was. I still have moments of fear, but there's some growth there. And you show me the stuff that you go through, and hopefully that makes sense. And if there's anyone, I'm sure there's someone in the audience today or someone listening to this CD that's fearful, that just needs to be inspired a little bit, whether it's by the chairperson or three people or just... So you inspire me. I have 2 minutes left, I think. 3 minutes left. 2 minutes left, and he just wants to get me out of here before I get gas. So the other thing that I did was, with your help, I replaced negative with positive. And with fear, I face emotions and recover a day at a time. And for a long, long time, it was negative. I used to write negative lyrics. And you've helped me turn something from negative into positive. And it's a little poem I wrote, and it is actually mine. But if you can use it, use it. And freedom doesn't have to be, it could be freedom from alcohol, but it's an inside job, they told me. Anyway, this poem is called Freedom. Freedom is something that you don't take lightly, something that you don't care to risk, because once you lose your sobriety, your freedom is what you most miss. The only freedom some people have is when they overdrink. They take a sip and they think they're hip, but they never stop to think. So think about this thing of ours. Some people just throw it away. And remember that AA is not a must, because it could leave you any day. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
You're lucky you don't have to speak after them. I have that problem. George, thank you very much, and I just want to remember you that promises are coming always, sometimes slowly. Yes, sir. But sometimes slowly. Depends. I missed that one. Okay. And I was thinking when George was talking to you that as AA is a spiritual movement, each time I have to speak on behalf of AA or on behalf of myself or whatever, I have to talk about God. So I always tell him before I start talking that because it's a spiritual movement, if you don't want to look foolish, give me the right words. So I understand he missed a cut today. Don't worry, you have plenty of others meeting to come today and tomorrow. I would like to thank each and everyone that was with us this morning, the three speakers, LaPeter, David, and George. For me, it was a fantastic experience again to speak to you. I would like to thank you to have accepted me the way I am. You just forget to tell me that I have to accept you the way you are. That's what I work on it since the last 19 years, and I still go on that one. I will have leave sometime, so if people want to thank those speakers and to be in our time, I really appreciate your patience and your discipline, which I'm always surprised. And if you wish to join, we will finish with the Serenity Prayer. In the language of your choice, I will confuse you. Dieu, donne-moi la sérénité d'accepter les choses que je ne peux changer, le courage de changer les choses que je peux, et la sagesse de connaître la différence. Think, keep coming back.